98.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. Streaming around the universe on kpfk.org, where you can check out our past shows, podcasts, and more. KPFK is powered by you, the listener.
Well, good afternoon, friends. Good afternoon, and welcome to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host, Maria Hall, and we've got a good show for you today. Maria, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Jim. How are you?
I'm just fine, despite the news of the day.
That's right.
You ask people how they're doing, you have to separate how they're doing from how the world is doing and how they feel about it. Well, we've got a full show today, so let's get right to it. Because, of course, June 30th, just yesterday, marked the close of the U.S. Supreme Court's official 2026 term. And there were a number of highly significant rulings, such as the decision on birthright citizenship, transgender athletes, temporary protected status for immigrants from Hawaii and Syria, and, of course, decisions as well on the grant of power to the president to fire federal independent agency commissioners at will, the decision on Hawaii's gun law, the decision on asylum seekers, and a highly important decision on mail-in ballots. So discussing these and other cases is going to occupy us for the full hour. And, of course, our guest to inform us about these decisions is our go-to guest when we're dealing with the courts in the United States and their decisions, and as Stephen Rohde. Mr. Rohde is the author of two books and numerous articles and book reviews on constitutional law and history. He is the former president of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California, a special advisor on free speech and the First Amendment for the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Steve Rohde is also the host of a new podcast called Speaking Freely, produced by Miz Studios, and is available on Spotify and iHeartRadio and other streaming platforms. I should mention that Steve Rohde is also, along with Maria Hall and myself, co-host of the National Public Affairs Show entitled Law and Disorder, now airing on close to 200 radio stations in the United States. Well, Steve Rohde, a warm welcome to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show.
Jim and Maria, thank you so much for devoting time to these important cases. I couldn't be in a better place.
Well, good. We look forward to it whenever we have you on, which is often now. There's just so much going on in the courts. And one of the most widely discussed cases, of course, this year was the birthright citizenship case. Trump tried to get rid of it with what the Constitution says about it by executive order, I think on his first day in office or something. How did the Supreme Court rule on the matter of birthright citizenship, and why?
Well, in a bottom line sense, Trump's executive order was struck down by the court. But you really have to dig deeper into this case to understand what a risk this poses going forward. The mainstream media has largely covered this case, applauding John Roberts for his independence from Donald Trump. Some commentators called it good news. One said the Supreme Court isn't Trump's lackey. Well, I beg to differ. In fact, some of the reporting has misunderstood exactly what the court did. So here's the breakdown. In a 5-4 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court said that Donald Trump's executive order, in which he purported to ban birthright citizenship among babies born in the United States to parents of undocumented persons, that they were not citizens. Four U.S. Supreme Court justices adopted Trump's position. I'm emphasizing this at the very top of our show to tell your listeners how close we came and may come to a constitutional crisis. This birthright citizenship issue has been clearly decided virtually over the entire history of the United States since the 14th Amendment was adopted. Cases have upheld the interpretation because the 14th Amendment says all persons born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. No one questioned this doctrine until Trump had a fever dream, originally questioning Barack Obama's citizenship, and then expanding this, and finally, when he took office the second time, elevating his fiction to an executive order. But what I'm emphasizing today is that four U.S. Supreme Court justices agreed with him. We were one vote away from losing this fundamental protection for every person that is born in the United States. Now, Roberts dressed up his opinion. He wrote for the majority. There was a 6-3 majority that struck down Trump's executive order because it violated a federal statute regarding citizenship. And in that case, Justice Brett Kavanaugh joined, making that a 6-3 decision. But that's a statute, and there are already moves to go to Congress to reverse what the Supreme Court has done. Roberts said that children born of parents lawfully or temporarily present in the United States satisfy both elements of the citizenship clause. Under the Constitution, he concluded, they are citizens at birth. But what's most revealing is the dissenting opinions, including Justice Samuel Alito. He called the ruling one of the most important decisions in the history of the court. Well, that's true, but he called it a serious mistake. He said careful analysis of the text of the 14th Amendment and the process that led to its adoption shows that it did not degrade the concept of U.S. citizenship in this way. Instead, the 14th Amendment confers citizenship on only those children who at birth owe allegiance solely to this country. I mean, this is virtually a loyalty oath on American citizens, and it's shameful, but he gathered four votes for that position. The lower courts have been very clear about this. Back on July 10, a federal judge in New Hampshire issued a preliminary injunction that blocked the government from enforcing Trump's executive order. That judge said that the executive order, it was a preliminary injunction, so he said likely, contradicts the text of the 14th Amendment and the century-old untouched precedent that interprets it. There's a very important concurrence in this case by Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, because she's answering a separate dissent by Clarence Thomas, that wonderful eminent historian, Clarence Thomas, tried to limit the 14th Amendment only to newly freed slaves. Now, that was ironic for him to say that the 14th Amendment is race conscious, because in other opinions, they have said the 14th Amendment cannot take race into consideration, and laws that approve diversity, equity, inclusion, and affirmative action are unconstitutional. Now, all of a sudden, when he wants to favor this position, he considers the 14th Amendment race conscious. Well, Ketanji Brown Jackson nails this historically, and I just urge listeners, you can find these opinions online. The dissents in everything we're going to be talking about today are so important, because Jackson develops the solid analysis that the 14th Amendment was both race conscious and universal. It's an example that's emerging in this 250th anniversary that many of the rights that the rest of us take for granted have only been won by the struggles of those who were denied protection under the original Declaration of Independence and the original Constitution. Women, enslaved people, minorities, American Indians, and the poor. So I'm grateful in that sense that the birthright citizenship executive order was struck down, but by Republicans have already run to the docket and said they're going to try to pass laws which limit the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment is in the Constitution. It's a constitutional amendment. It can only be amended by a constitutional amendment. And what the court was facing is the consistent interpretation, going back to 1898 in a case called Wong Kim Ark, where citizenship was granted to the son of Chinese immigrants. And the whole thing was enacted in 1868 to reverse Dred Scott, one of the most abominable decisions in our history. But now the conservative dissenters are resurrecting that analysis. So let's take what we can in terms of a victory, but let's not be fooled that this is somehow a sign of an independent Roberts Court. The Roberts Court, as we'll see in other decisions, is doing Trump's bidding.
Well, Steve, let's change gears for a moment. The Supreme Court also made a ruling about transgender athletes yesterday. Tell us about this decision.
Yes, this came up from two laws in Idaho and West Virginia. And this is a case of doing Trump's bidding, doing MAGA bidding, doing Republican bidding, because the court held that individual states can exclude transgender athletes from women's and girls' sports teams. The court said that these laws do not violate the federal civil rights laws, but they were divided on whether the laws violate the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. In a 29-page opinion, Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who would never deign in his entire opinion to use the phrase transgender athletes, he wrote, in his view, for the majority, consistent with Title IX and the Equal Protection Clause, we hold that the states may maintain women's and girls' sports for biological females. They may determine eligibility for women and girls' sports based on biological sex. The Constitution and Title IX do not require an overhaul of women's and girls' sports throughout America. Once again, this time, Sonia Sotomayor, in an opinion joined by Justices Elena Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson, contended that the majority extends great sympathy to those it favors, the young cisgender girls and women who play sports. I share that sympathy. Playing sports can lead to benefits that are immeasurable, and many are understandably invested in ensuring that competition stays fair and safe. Because the majority, however, inflicts a hardship on those it disfavors without giving them the full and fair opportunity the Constitution requires to litigate their contentions, I respectfully dissent. One of the cases came from West Virginia. The other came from Idaho. 25 other states have enacted similar bans. One challenger was Lindsay Hecox, who filed this lawsuit because she wanted to try out for women's track and cross-country teams at Boise State University in Idaho. The other challenger, Becky Pepper Jackson, identified by her initials as a 15-year-old high school student who had publicly identified as female since the third grade. Both of those individuals went to court. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit agreed with Hecox that the Idaho law violates the 14th Amendment guarantee of equal treatment and prohibited Idaho from enforcing the ban. The court reasoned that the Idaho law was intended to categorically, the law that was challenged, to ban transgender women and girls from public school sports teams that corresponded to their gender identity. The law discriminates on the basis of sex, the lower court ruled, because athletes on girls and women's team are subject to invasive sex verification procedures to implement the policy, while athletes on boys and men's teams are not. And likewise, a federal district court in Richmond, Virginia, struck down the West Virginia law for much of the same reasons. Yet, with all of that judicial support and analysis, when it got up to the Supreme Court, those laws were upheld. They're going to wreak havoc within the transgender community. They set other precedents that may go beyond student sports teams. That case is an example of the arch conservative 6-member majority doing Trump's bidding.
Yep. Well, there are thousands and thousands of Haitian and Syrian immigrants in America, of course, Steve. And the Supreme Court has, this last term, has ruled on the matter of the temporary protective status that they've enjoyed. How did they rule, and what was their reasoning behind their ruling?
Yes, this was troubling because of the sweeping impact it's going to have on those communities, Haitian and Syrian immigrants in the United States. And by definition, it could spread to others who have reached the United States and been protected. The Supreme Court, again, in a 6-3 ruling, cleared the way for the federal government to remove protections for citizens from Haiti and Syria under a federal program that allows foreign citizens to stay in the United States when the U.S. government believes it is not safe for them to return to their homes. This was the case of Mullen versus Doe. The justices had paused rulings of lower federal courts, which had upheld temporary protected status, that's the TPS, for both Haitians and Syrians. The court ruled that these programs bar the courts from even reviewing the determination by then Secretary of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem, to end TPS designations for Haiti and Syria. The court held they are likely to lose their claim, despite the fact that serious racial discrimination case instances are also raised in this case. Well, this time, and I can only imagine how the three liberal women judges are dividing up their work, because in this case, Helen Elena Kagan wrote an opinion joined by Sotomayor and Jackson. She wrote that at this stage in the litigation, the Haitian and Syrian TPS beneficiaries ask only one thing, that they may stay in the country while they continue to litigate their claims. They are entitled to that relief and should not instead be consigned to devastating and indeed life-threatening injury. Congress enacted this TPS program back in 1990. It did give the Department of Homeland Security the power to designate citizens as eligible to remain in the United States in order to be safe where their home country has suffered a natural disaster, armed conflict, or other extraordinary and temporary conditions. Haiti and Syria were designated for those purposes, and the head of Homeland Security continuously renewed their TPS status. As a result, a tremendous reliance was created within those communities in the United States as these legally present people were able to build lives and work and do all the rest. But that changed in the case of Trump, and now with the blessing of the court. One of the most remarkable things is there was an allegation of that this was racially motivated in the case of Haiti, based on evidence that was presented. Well, Kagan had to point out that it's plain to see that race played a role in the decision to terminate the DTPS designation for Haiti. The evidence, she said, that's been offered has statements by the president so repellent and racially inflected that the majority declines to put them in print. Well, she had no trepidation of putting them in print, and most of us who are paying attention have heard these statements. Donald Trump accused Haitians in Ohio of eating dogs and cats, described Haiti as a shithole country, and contended that Haitians living in the U.S. probably have AIDS. These were overtly racial comments. They clearly raised the question of equal protection of the law, and the case should have been fully reviewed rather than in the decision last week, which now allows the government to expel these Haitian refugees even while the underlying issues go forward. It could affect 350,000 Haitians, 6,100 Syrians, and other minorities. I'm deeply concerned. This is a case that reveals the cruelty not only of the Trump administration, but the majority on the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Pacifica's KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. I'm Maria Hall here with my co-host, Jim Lafferty. We're speaking right now with constitutional law scholar Stephen Rohde, and we're talking about the wave of Supreme Court decisions that came out in the last week. Steve, along similar lines, the Supreme Court also decided a case last week concerning the rights of people seeking asylum in the United States. How did they rule, and what will be the impact?
Yeah, it's important to couple this case with the last one. The Supreme Court, again, 6-3, held that the federal government policy of systematically turning back asylum seekers before they reach U.S. soil is lawful and can continue to be enforced. Some of this opinion was a technical etymological debate over the word arrive. When do you arrive in the United States? Samuel Alito wrote for the majority that that was straightforward. You have to step on U.S. soil to have arrived here. But Sonia Sotomayor, who took the unprecedented, unusual step of reading large portions of her dissent from live on the day of decision, she wrote that the consequences of today's decision are predictable. More people will die, more people will attempt to cross the border illegally, and some will make it while others will not. This is a program called metering. At the border, border patrol agents regularly block asylum seekers from setting foot in the United States, literally preventing them now under this Supreme Court ruling from being able to commence and pursue their asylum claim. These are asylum seekers seeking refuge in the United States because of the conditions in their home countries, which are not safe. Today, there's a serious question whether individuals will be sent back to the home countries, and that's why Sotomayor spoke of it being deadly. The Court of Appeals agreed on the Ninth Circuit, agreed with the challengers that having been turned away by the officials, they had arrived sufficiently to invoke the protections of the law. Congress used the phrase physically present in the United States in a separate statute. And if that's what they meant, they could have said physically present in the United States in this statute. Clarence Thomas filed a concurring opinion, but Sotomayor's 35-page dissent was extraordinary. She said Congress passed the Refugee Act of 1980 because it did not want this country to repeat the mistakes of its past. Yet if refugees on the MS St. Louis, a ship carrying more than 900 Jewish refugees seeking escape from Nazi Germany, had been turned away from the United States and eventually returned to Western Europe to die, that was their fate. If they were to walk up to a port of entry in our southern border today, the majority's interpretation would allow immigration officers to refuse even to consider their asylum application by physically blocking them from stepping foot into and onto U.S. soil. This is what we're up against. The area of immigration may now return to Congress, and I put it on one of the agendas for the newly elected Democratic House and Senate in the midterms to address this and make it very clear that these asylum seekers are protected as soon as they arrive at the border.
Absolutely should be. Well, another 5-4 decision. This one has the Supreme Court ruling that states may, and Trump, of course, was furious about the decision because the Supreme Court ruled in this case that states may, in fact, count ballots mailed by election day but received days later. And apparently also a lower court decision is has been rendered in this case as well, in this kind of case as well. So talk to us about both of these cases, if you would.
Well, this is one more example that we've got to take crumbs when they're offered. This is a 5-4 decision, meaning that four justices would have struck down this Mississippi law. So by upholding the law, the Mississippi law allows mail-in ballots to be counted as long as they are postmarked by and received within 5 days of election day. So there are many states with similar laws. That means that the mail-in ballot must be postmarked on or before election day, but may be counted, in this case, during the next 5 days. It was somewhat refreshing to see Justice Amy Coney Barrett write for the 5-member majority, which was made up of her, Chief Justice John Roberts, Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson. Barrett took a realistic approach that one must vote by election day, but the count of the vote may be conducted for a reasonable period thereafter. Election day statutes require the electorate's choice to be made before or on election day, but so long as they meet that deadline, election day statutes allow the counting of those ballots, in this case, within 5 days later. But once again, four justices of the Supreme Court, led by a dissenting opinion from Justice Alito, tried to read the relevant statutes tightly and suggesting that all the ballots had to be in and counted on election day. 14 states plus the District of Columbia allow for postmarking by election day and counting thereafter, and 29 states and the District of Columbia allow military and overseas ballots to also be postmarked on or before, but counted later. What's done here is to carve out one more platform of the Republican Party that this court is pursuing. Project 2025, the Republican Party, they see how they lose elections when there is free, open, and ample opportunities for people to vote. Mail-in voting has become popular throughout the United States. Donald Trump used mail-in voting in a recent election of his own. And we are hopeful that this kind of law will be upheld consistently as other states use this method of mail-in ballots. Certainly, a one-vote margin is too slim, but thank goodness it went in favor of open and accessible voting. And we're hopeful that will be the sign of the day as other challenges to voting rights continue.
All right, well, let's take a brief station identification now. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with you.
Hello, I'm Ian Masters, the host of Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org and heard on KPFK Mondays through Thursdays at 5 p.m. and on Sundays at 11 a.m. Background Briefing looks into three or four of the important stories and issues of the day to provide an in-depth daily briefing with context, history, and insight from the best-informed guests closest to the scene, who offer analysis and details often overlooked by the soundbite-driven media more and more controlled by Trump-friendly oligarchs. So if you want facts and information to inform a motivated majority to save our democracy before it's stolen next November, tune in Mondays to Thursdays at 5 p.m. and on Sundays at 11 a.m. for your Background Briefing here on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and worldwide at kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson. You're listening to Radical Free Speech Radio, KPFK in Los Angeles.
And we are back with you. You're still listening to the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with you as well. My guest today is Stephen Rohde. We're devoting the entire hour to consideration of those Supreme Court decisions that came down in the last week and some of the cases as well. We're going to take it away on your next question.
All right. Thanks, Jim. Well, on Monday, the Supreme Court decided the president may fire federal independent agency commissioners at will. Steve, tell us more about this ruling and what it signals for us all going forward.
This is a very dangerous decision. I may keep saying that, but this one affects such a broad area of American government and what it does and has done for centuries, that this decision dislodges and upsets in my view, unconstitutional way. So specifically, the court yesterday gave Trump sweeping new authority over approximately two dozen multi-member agencies that Congress intended to be independent. By a vote of 6-3, the justices struck down a federal law that bars the president from firing members of the Federal Trade Commission, except in cases of inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office. Now, that was a law passed by Congress at the time it created the Federal Trade Commission. It allowed the president to appoint commissioners, but only to remove them on those specific grounds for cause. Now, that law now, according to this majority, violates the constitutional separation of powers between the three branches of government. And to get to that result, the conservative majority had to overrule a 91-year-old decision in a case called Humphrey's Executor versus the United States, which has consistently been applied and upheld by Congress, presidents, and the courts ever since. John Roberts, in this case, showing his true colors, wrote the majority opinion. He said the president must have the assistance of officers he can trust, although it's up to the Senate to decide whether to confirm them with whom he prefers to work. Neither Congress nor the courts may, quote, saddle him with those with whom he cannot work. Well, as I hinted at the beginning of this program, this is now the elevation of the highly conservative theory, the unitary executive theory. This emerged in the 1980s under Ronald Reagan with conservative professors like Robert Bork and Ed Meese and others, putting a single person, the president, in charge of the entire executive branch, and that his powers could not be impinged upon even by Congress. Sotomayor wrote a 49-page opinion. She said, today the court discards the democratic regime created by the Constitution in favor of one that distorts the structure of government to fit the majority's theory of unitary total executive control. The result, she concluded, is a president who emerges with far more power than ever before. This case can't be viewed in isolation. 2 years ago, in the correctly named case, Donald Trump versus the United States, gave the president immunity from criminal prosecution for crimes committed as president. Now they are marching through the law as it affects all of these independent agencies. Trump had nominated Rebecca Slaughter to fill a Democratic seat on the FTC. Biden renominated her in 2023. But right off the bat, Trump fired Slaughter, not for cause, but because her service would be inconsistent with my political agenda. This is going to introduce the spoil system, where loyalty to the president takes precedent over expertise, knowledge, and experience. The court continued to pursue this notion, despite the fact that the courts have consistently, and under the doctrine of stare decisis, courts are not supposed to overturn longstanding precedents like the Humphreys case without a real legal foundation, not just the whims of six members on the court. In dissent, Sotomayor stressed that Congress established these agencies to address complex problems while enjoying some independence from presidential removal and thus absolute partisan control. This decision gives the president a power unknown even to the English crown against which the founders resulted. She concluded that the decision reshapes our government. Dozens of independent commissions are now likely to become purely executive agencies, shifting tremendous power over broad swaths of the American life, including the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and the Merit Systems Protection Board. This was a huge win for Trump and the unitary executive theory, and a big loss for the American people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would argue another loss for the American people, but you tell me, Steve. The Supreme Court this week overturned a Hawaiian gun law. So what did that law say, and what was the basis for the high court overturning it?
Yes, I realized we were turning to that case, and I forgot to include there was one glimmer with regard to these commissioners. Lisa Cook, who is a Federal Reserve Board governor, She was allowed to stay in office, and in a 5-4 decision in which Roberts flipped along with Kavanaugh, Lisa Cook can remain as a Federal Reserve Board governor. What's ironic about this is you read this opinion, and Roberts gives all the reasons why this agency needs independence from the President of the United States when he just got done destroying those principles in the Slaughter case. So we're going to have to continue to follow this case as well, and hopefully there will be some independence, at least for the Federal Reserve. In terms of your specific question, here is originalism on steroids, another 6-3 decision. The court struck down a Hawaii law that made it a crime for gun owners to bring their guns onto private property that is open to the public, such as restaurants and hotels, unless they have the property owner's specific consent. 6-3, the justices agreed with some gun owners that the law violates the Second Amendment guarantee of the right to bear arms. This is a law in Hawaii, but four other states, including California, Maryland, New York, and New Jersey, are affected. This was the written by the fan of gun rights, Samuel Alito. He said it hobbles the Second Amendment. What's ironic is Ketanji Brown Jackson said, wait a minute, we're talking about property rights. You could almost hear her say, we thought you conservatives supported property rights, and how can we object that the bringing of a gun onto private property without the permission of the owner of that property is somehow unconstitutional. Both sides battled on the history of gun ownership and restrictions on that ownership because the majority is so taken with their originalism theory that looks back to the 18th century. This is a serious setback for reasonable, sensible gun laws, and it's just an indication of what this majority will do with the power they have on the court.
Mm-hmm. Well, Steve, you've talked to us in prior shows about a concept called the unified executive theory, and you've warned about its potential to undermine our constitutional democracy. Can you remind us what this is, unified executive theory, and how the Supreme Court's rulings over the past week tie into it?
Yes. As I use it, it's also referred to as the unitary executive theory. I may have misled you in the notes. But this is what I've been talking about for the first part of the show. And it gives me a moment to reflect on what you'd think the conservatives would actually look at the text of the U.S. Constitution. They're so fond of that. But we have separation of powers in the U.S. Constitution, and Congress passes laws. And what does the Constitution say about a president's powers? Well, in Article 2, Section 3, it says two things. The first is often overlooked, even by commentators. The president may recommend such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. Look at what role the president's relegated to. He can recommend laws to Congress, not enact them by himself through sweeping executive orders. I'd like to see that provision of Article 2 used more in these court cases. But secondly, it says the duty of the president is to, quote, take care that the laws be faithfully executed. What's his job or her job someday? To take care that laws, and those are the laws passed by Congress and signed by presidents, unless there's an override, be faithfully executed. He's an executive. It's the executive branch. You execute laws. You don't write laws. you don't invent laws and you don't make up laws. The unitary executive theory casts all of that aside. It ignores the actual text of the Constitution. It was considered a minority view. In one case years ago, only Justice Antonin Scalia adopted the theory. But now it is the prevailing analysis of constitutional law. It cabins us. It limits us to the 18th century. We are frozen in amber in what the founders claimed or said. And that's why I wanted to devote a few minutes to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, another blow, perhaps, Clarence Thomas. Clarence Thomas, in a case, just gave us, or gave Border Patrol agents, I should say, a terrifying new power, as far as I think we would be concerned. What is that new power that he gave him, and what basis did the court rule as it did?
Yes, well, now it'll come as no surprise in a 6-3 decision called Blanche versus Lau. Federal immigration officers do not need clear and convincing evidence that a green card holder has committed a disqualifying crime before preventing them from re-entering the country for an indefinite stay. This was a case of Mr. Mok Chau Lau, who in June 2012, he was a green card holder. That means he had permanent legal status. He left the country, he returned, and when he returned, he was stopped at the border, stripped of his green card status because he had been indicted but not convicted of committing a crime. The dissenters in this case, Justice Brown, said the court has handed the government a massive blank check to put lawful permanent residents in immigration limbo. So now, if they have stepped out of the country or reasonably under the expectation, which is true for decades, that they could return having a legal green card, now on a suspicion of a crime, without clear and convincing evidence, they can be stopped. Justice Brown said Congress could not have meant for the grantees afforded to lawful permanent residents to be so cavalierly swept aside. One more case, Trump has pushed the law as far as he could or farther, and the conservative majority is doing his bidding in upholding that policy.
So when it comes to green card holders, you're not innocent until proven guilty.
Yeah, you're actually guilty until you're proven innocent.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. Well, Steve, the Supreme Court allowed a lower court ruling that curtails the protection of minority voters in seven states. What rule did they allow to go into effect?
Well, this was a case where they wouldn't even allow the case to go forward. So they denied cert. No opinions were issued. It takes four votes to get a case onto the docket. And apparently there were not four votes because there are only three liberal justices. This was an Eighth Circuit decision. When a circuit court is upheld, it is simply a precedent for that circuit. But this covers Arkansas, Iowa, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, North Dakota, and South Dakota. So now individuals do not have the right to sue to enforce Section 208 of the Voting Rights Act. Well, what is that? That was a very important section in the Voting Rights Act, which allows voters with a disability to read or write, to get help with voting from a person of their choice. This is state laws now allow, I'm sorry, the Supreme Court, by denying cert, the lower court said only the U.S. Attorney General could sue Arkansas law barred persons who are not a poll watcher to help voters, though they wanted to have a person with them English speaking and translating for these Spanish speaking voters. The district judge found that the Arkansas law violated Section 208, which did allow you to have someone accompany you, but the Eighth Circuit ruled that they did not even have a right to sue. But this is a conflict with cases allowing private rights of action. And usually when there's a conflict between circuits, the Supreme Court grants review. Well, this Supreme Court is certainly not indulgent to the right of people to sue to protect their voting rights, and as a result would not even hear this case. A new Congress, as we hope and pray, could clarify and make it clear that the law allows a private right of action, that individuals can use the civil rights laws to enforce a provision like this one. They don't have to wait for an attorney general to do so. I'm putting it on the checklist of new laws we need when we take back Congress.
Mm-hmm. Well, another gun case law. This is the case I'm speaking of U.S. versus Habani, where the Supreme Court limited federal authority to disarm marijuana users. Tell us about this case.
Now, this was interesting because it's a unanimous decision, and it was unanimous drawing on different theories and different attitudes toward these laws and toward the use of marijuana. Daniel Habani was convicted in 2023 under the Gun Control Act. That act prohibits gun ownership by an unlawful user of or addicted to any controlled substance. The court found common ground here, but for different policy reasons, in an opinion written for the unanimous court by Neil Gorsuch. What the justices could agree upon is to say that categorically a marijuana user is violent and dangerous without any other evidence of such is not a proposition that should be adopted. Given the widespread use that nearly half of Americans have used marijuana in their lifetimes and some persistently, this actually was a small but good example of the court finding common ground so that you are not automatically treated as a violent criminal if you have a marijuana violation. Only if we could see the court find common ground and be reasonable on these other cases.
Yes, indeed.
Well, Steve, there's a question about religious freedom. So a prison guard, over the religious objection of the inmate, shaved off his dreadlocks. The inmate sued and the case reached the Supreme Court. How did the court rule on this one and why?
Yeah, now we're back to these 6-3 decisions again. Damon Landor is a Rastafarian who practices that religion and in this case had very long dreadlocks. The majority opinion was written by Neil Gorsuch. When Mr. Landor was taken into custody, the police guards forcibly shaved his head and removed all of his curls. What this court said is despite that clear violation of his rights under the Constitution and a statute, Mr. Landor cannot sue for damages given what was inflicted on him. We have the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, It requires states to accommodate religious rights as a condition of accepting federal funds. And it provides that prisoners can sue for appropriate relief. But that now the court decided that individual prison guards are not liable for money damages, that the only kind of relief is against the state itself that has the overseer of those individuals who actually committed the civil rights violation. Again, in a forceful and clear-minded dissent,
sometimes
Justice Jackson said that Congress intended both the government and government officials to be sued. Inmates are left remediless for religious violations, and prison officials have little incentive to abide by federal law if they know they can't be sued for damages. This is a troubling decision. This is a court that in many other areas bends over backwards to use religious rights to strike down other laws. It's revealing to see how facile they are when in this case a disfavored religion is at the heart of the case. Most of the religious cases the conservatives uphold are Christian religious cases. Congress could amend the law to make a private right of action for damages against individual guards and officials available. And again, I'm putting that on the to-do list once we take back Congress.
Right. Well, finally, in our last, we're running out of time here, but the Supreme Court rejected Trump's appeal, did it not, of the $5 million verdict against him in the E. Jean Carroll case, the sexual harassment case. Tell us about this.
Well, this is such a happy note to end our conversation. E. Jean Carroll, I understand there's a new documentary out on her life. She's been a courageous woman throughout her life and her career. In 2023, she sued Donald Trump civilly for sexual abuse and defamation, for accusing her of lying and making those charges. She won a $5 million verdict that has worked its way through all of the courts. And fortunately, the U.S. Supreme Court denied Trump's appeal. They didn't give reasons. There were no dissents. They simply have left that judgment in place. Let's remember that in January of 2024, there was a separate case that Carroll brought against Trump. And in that case, she won an $83.3 million verdict for defamation. That case has moved up through the courts. There's no doubt Trump will exhaust himself and the courts in appealing that case. I'm hopeful the Supreme Court does exactly what it does, and maybe given public reporting of how many billions of dollars Trump is worth, he can spend some of it by paying E. Jean Carroll.
Yes, indeed. He owes her a good deal of money. Well, Steve Rohde, thank you again. You did it. You managed to get in all those cases within the hour. We applaud you for doing so, and thank you for doing so. Our music tells us that is indeed the end of our show for this week. We are grateful for all those who listened to the Lawyers Guild show this week. We hope you'll listen again next week when we'll have different topics. Until then, this is Jim Lafferty and Maria Hall thanking you for listening today. Urging you to stay healthy, my friends, and as the music is about to tell you, to stay active and stand up for your rights.
Heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an old that Peter is gold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on,
get up, stand up. Hi, I'm Ashley Judd, and I believe that when we listen collectively, change happens. And I believe we should listen to girls and women. I believe that girls and women should speak for themselves, with